The date is what? October the 24th?
24th.
1978. This is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane by Reg Roy at University of Victoria. Right.
Well, we're on Air Transport Command, and I think the important thing about Air Transport Command in those days was really the operational concept. Here we had all this equipment. How were we really going to use it, other than in a major emergency such as a national emergency or an international emergency or even United Nations operations? And when we had been doing all the planning for the system that I was now told to put into effect, the concept we evolved was actually a very simple one, but once it's laid on the table, but it took us quite some time to get to it. And it was very simple. We started with, all right, we have a pilot. How many hours a month can a pilot fly under normal conditions, under pressure, normal conditions, or in an emergency? And so we established levels, if you will, of operational capability. Then we said, all right, now what would be the norm in peacetime that would be required to keep him very, very, very proficient on that machine? So we really had three levels. We had a normal peacetime operating level of hours per month per pilot. That which he could endure on an extended basis, by an extended basis, I'm talking in terms of, say, 3 months, which would be 7 days a week type of thing, going flat out. And then, of course, that which would be absolutely flat out for a short period of time, say, something less than a month. And those latter two, of course, crew fatigue or pilot fatigue is a criteria. We very rapidly came, and one thing that we always sold, and I had to use many times later on under periods of pressure, was that there's no point in pushing a pilot beyond a certain point, because if he's carrying 150 people in the back of the airplane and he writes them all off, what have you achieved? Or even if he doesn't have 150 people, he's got freight, and he writes off an airplane and himself, yeah, what has been achieved? Nothing. And there, as individuals do vary physically, one has to leave it up to the squadron commander to when you get beyond a certain point, where his judgment must prevail in stopping and saying, you do not fly. You must now take 3 days off, catch up on your rest, your sleep, and so forth. You can have very difficult operations. What a pilot could endure, say, in summertime, he could not endure in wintertime, when he's doing difficult letdowns, running into icing conditions, all the things which add to the mental fatigue of flying. Well, having established those levels, we said, all right, now if that's what we can do, then we now can start working on hours. Well, we very rapidly arrived at the point where in peacetime, the number of hours that we would have to fly were considerable, very considerable, because we would then be in a position to step up very rapidly. Now, I'm sorry, I've been talking about the pilots. I must not talk about the ground crew, because airplanes have to go through inspections, X number of flying hours or X number of months, depending on the system being used. And they must go through the barn and be given a full inspection. Well, you need ground crew to do that. You need your technicians. And, of course, the more frequent you come up with an inspection, the larger the number of ground crew, because you have the airplanes going through the hangar more rapidly, and therefore you need more people. So the ground crew had to be determined as well. So we had the two sides, the two important aspects of the number of hours we could fly per month. One was a ground crew, another was the air crew. So we established the level that was a peacetime operation, so that we could go up to this stepped-up operation without too much difficulty, because we'd have the ground crew as well as the pilots. The pilots could do the flying, but they had to have enough ground crew who also, by working extended hours over an extended period, could keep the airplanes flying. Well, the result was a fair number of hours on a monthly basis. Take a squadron of Yukons, say 12 Yukons. We were talking about a very large lift capability. And therefore, what were we going to do with this lift capability in peacetime, in the quiet period, when there was no emergency of any kind? How were we going to use this lift? Well, it was there, of course, we went on to the next thing of setting up and such things as rotating all of our personnel in Europe by air. Where they had gone by ship previously, we would now do it by air, because we had set, as a part of this whole system, we had set up the air movements units. at the major places across Canada, they would be a part of the system. Air movements, say, in overseas, and Trenton, and Winnipeg, and Edmonton, and Vancouver. And we also had said that once we do this rotation, of course, we're going to have to be able to react if an airplane is delayed 24 hours for whatever reason, weather or what have you. So we're going to have a hotel. Well, and that was the next little bit of this total system.
Yeah.
Because you had to have a place to put families, because we said we'll move dependents, not just the troops, everybody. And in addition, we would fly the luggage, we would fly all the spare parts, engines, which were being overhauled in England, we would fly back and have overhauled in Canada, so that we could keep our own plants going. And as far as we were concerned, we were just making use of the hours.
Yeah.
I must make this quite clear. We could have bored holes in the sky to keep our pilots proficient and keep our ground crew up to a level where we could expand rapidly to in a panic. We didn't realize how close we were, because ultimately, as I come to it, we were put up against the stops in this business of operating flat out. We had to do that, but instead of boring holes in the sky, let's make use of the airlift and let's save money. Although it may sound crazy,
yeah.
And the contradiction of you're doing a lot of flying, but you can save money in other ways. Well, that was what we put forward, and to the chief of staff, and over a great deal of opposition, particularly from the Army. The thought of having to rely on us to fly them over and bring them back, they didn't like one bit. They were quite happy about us lifting a battalion and doing exercises and that sort of thing, which I'll get onto that in a minute in terms of how we applied the concept. But they fought the concept because they realized that they were going to lose their ships and the traveling by ship and so forth, which to the Army was a great holiday.
So
they didn't like that.
Yeah.
Well, it was accepted. The concept was accepted of flying at a fairly high peacetime rate, so that we would have the resources to go flat out in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And we then began to test the system, because this up until now had been all theory.
Yeah.
And we began to get the aircraft. We had the Yukons coming in, which was the biggest airplane that had ever been in the Canadian Armed Forces. A big lift, long range.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
you would also have capabilities on that to serve meals for a long time.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yes, quite.
Galleys,
in other words, an airline.
Yeah.
An airline in all respects. But we were also, of course, backed up by all the 130s that we had, which could carry vehicles, they could carry heavy equipment like engines on engine stands, airplane engines on engine stands, palletized equipment. Now, I just mentioned the word palletized. Just there alone, we had to set a team to work to figure out, now, what kind of systems do we need to handle all this?
Yeah.
You have to have loaders, you have to have pallets, you have to have what they call the ball-bearing floor, which goes in, so you can roll the pallets in. And all of these things had to be adaptable. We had to be able to put them in quickly or take them out. Because if you're going to take vehicles, you didn't want roller bearings on the floor. You just want to drive the vehicle in, lash it down. And then we had to be able to convert with the Yukons from being a freighter, carrying a lot of freighter or vehicles, we carry vehicles in the Yukons as well, to a passenger configuration, carrying troops. So we had to be able to put the seats in a hurry. And we had to be able to reconfigure an airplane in a matter of about an hour to an hour and a half, and this went a lot of work. It meant a lot of practice, and you had, again, to have... Now, this is where these air movements units come in, because the air movements people would work with the technicians and doing all this work. So it was manpower, as much as anything else. But we had to be flexible. And the one thing about an airplane, and again, one of the other part of our concept was the principle of flexibility. We could use the airplanes in any direction that they were required quickly, not have to wait 6 weeks before we could make a conversion. It had to be done in a matter of minutes, or hours, certainly, rather than days or weeks. So we thought this all through. We finally got all the equipment, and the system was really ready to go. Well, before we then started to do some exercises with the Army, because after all, this was the final analysis was the important thing, which was to move battalions and the recce units and the artillery and so forth. So we cranked up some exercises and put the whole thing to test. For example, we took the Bandus and the RCRs. Those days, the RCRs, well, they're still at London, they were then. And we took the Vandus from Valcarce and flew them out to Wainwright. Well, we had to, so again, we had to do a lot of planning. We had to, for example, use the Yukons to fly the people to Edmonton. The Yukon couldn't go into Wainwright, which was more of a strip than an airfield. So then we'd use the 130s, partly to lift all their heavy equipment from both London and Quebec, right into Wainwright, but then we'd have to use other ones to shuttle the troops back and forth. And the key was that the troops and the equipment had to arrive together. This was the other thing the army just hated. They hated. And we could understand why. They hated separating the men from their equipment, naturally. But it was the only way you could move quickly and efficiently from an air point of view.
Yeah.
And, of course, from the ground, from the army's point of view, quickly, time being of the essence. And, boy, it took us a long time before we convinced the army or before they believed that we could more or less guarantee that the equipment would arrive at the same time as the soldiers did. On the ground, and he'd then marry them up before they got into action or into the operational phase. Well, we had a lot of troubles. All of the things that went wrong, crazy little things. Somebody would fill a jeep, at least the gas tank on a jeep, too much, and it would spill out into the airplane. So God, immediately you had gas in an airplane, and of course there's nothing worse. One spark and you've got a fire on your hands. Well, you don't want that. The jerry can wouldn't have been sealed properly, and it would leak before it was discovered. And, multitude of bombs. That's just on the loading side. On our own side, I mentioned that we had trouble with engines before on the Yukon. You'd get airborne, and then the airplane would lose an engine. Well, what do you do? Do you go back to Trenton for a new engine, or do you continue with the equipment? And here we now got the army, the troops, away from their equipment. Which do you do? Well, we had to make a decision that we would always, if it was possible, we'd always carry on the three engines, and particularly in Canada, because we could always recover it on a flight. There's always some place you could get down and go on and get the gridded equipment. Then we'd have a sick airplane. Now, how do we recover that sick airplane? Because it's a serial number, and it was supposed to go back and be loading up again for another serial, which had to be married together, and it became very, very complex. But it worked. It worked with hiccups and trials and tribulations, but gradually the army lads came around and they began to realize that, by God, this thing can work. And so we then began to get the full cooperation of the battalions, and of course the air movements shops. Mm-hmm. They would set up themselves. They, their own movements personnel would move in, and now they knew what the plot was, the scheme was, how to make them work. So the thing began to work as a team. Well, having got that far, those were just trials and working. And then, of course, we came to the real crunch. Now we're going to start handling wives and kids and so forth over to Europe. And by this time, we had put into Marville, literally, which was going to be the European terminal, a hotel, a facility, where folks could, if they were hung up for any reason, this is more coming back to Canada, they'd already come from the various wings all over, and there were no hotels around Marville for thousands of miles. They would be put into the hotel and stay overnight until the airplane was ready to go, whether it be weather or an unserviceability. Same thing at Trenton. Trenton, we built, put a big hotel into Trenton. Oh, I see a big hotel. We're talking about barrack blocks that were converted into rooms. Yep. We had to improve the wash facilities. We had to put playrooms in. You had to put in a room for baby bottles. It was incredible. Yeah. All of a sudden, we were napkin changers. That's right. We were in the hotel business. And we had to get people to run the hotels, managers, as such, get them into it. All the laundry facilities had to be organized. Well, and meals. Well, the meals were not too bad because they could be held in, they could be had in the messes. So that was easy. Well, we started to run it. And then again, the same problem. We were having so much trouble with the Yukons, with unserviceabilities. And one of the criteria that we used from a management point of view was late departures. Late departures. We kept a record of every departure. And if it was late, why was it late? Why was it late departing? And this way, you get on top of your problems, because there is a kickoff. And if a plane doesn't get off on time, something's wrong in the system. What is it? It
would rattle all the way down.
That's right. It would rattle all the way down. So we used to have a weekly meeting, as a matter of fact, to review all late departures, to determine the cause of the departure, of the late departure, and try and nail problems. Well, unsurface abilities, of course, was a big one, and particularly with the Yukon in the early days. And I can remember one, after we'd been running the system for a while, I went over to Air Division, and Larry Ray was then the Air Officer commanding the Air Division in Metz. And, of course, I'd known Larry for years and years, and, Jesus, he started to shout at me the minute I walked in his door, just blasting me because of the late departures, late arrivals, confusion from his point of view, and not the thing not working properly. And I just had to stand and take it because there was nothing I could do. Those were the times when we were lucky if we were getting 200 hours out of those damn Rolls-Royce engines on the Yukon, when they should have really been going to about 600. So there was difficult times. And then the Army, of course, felt the same way. Now, when we finally got to them, although our operational efficiency had improved somewhat by the time we started to move the Army, but when those poor people landed in Marville, they had to be bussed from there up to Soest. And, of course, that was another four-hour drive. So the long haul across the Atlantic, overnight, families, kids, and what have you. But, by God, over the years, it worked well. Sure, people were tired, very, very tired, but very seldom did we have anything which could even come close to being a casualty as a result of the fatigue and the tiredness. And if somebody really was in bad shape for whatever reason, because we always had the hotel facility at either end, and, of course, medical staff immediately available if there was a requirement. So that if we felt that somebody was in bad shape, then, of course, we handle it as a separate case, more like an air evac rather than as a straight passenger. Well, there we were in peacetime, and we were doing that sort of thing, and then all of us, of course, what happened, we get a UN operation. And whammo, away we go.
But before you get into that, how many squadrons and how many planes and aircraft?
Well, we're not... The Yukon squadron was 437 squadron, and they had 12... Well, we had 12 Yukons altogether. A couple of them were VIP airplanes, which the PM used to use, and cabinet and so forth. And we finally slipped those off and put those into 412 squadron, which was the VIP squadron at Ottawa.
Yeah.
So really we're talking about 10 airplanes, 10 Yukons. Then we had 435 and 436 squadrons, which were which had the 130s.
Yeah.
One in Edmonton and one originally at Toronto and then Ottawa and then finally it came to Trenton. Mm-hmm. But they had I guess it was 8 airplanes each. 8 airplanes, yes. So we had 16 130s and 10 Yukons. And that's a big lift.
What is the lift of that?
Well, it's hard to... a Yukon would take about 100 and...
Sorry.
The Yukon would carry about 150 troops. If we had to put troops in a 130, which we didn't like to do too often, but we did on... unless it was a short haul, you could get about 90. But they're in the old canvas seats. They're really the jump seats, the parachute jump seats, which were very, very uncomfortable. Another reason why we wouldn't take them on long hauls. But when it comes to equipment and so forth, you get all kinds of combinations. We could put the Jeeps in the Yukon, but you couldn't put anything bigger than a Jeep because the Yukon was a side loading, and you had to be able to turn the thing around on a pallet and run it in, drive it in. Mm-hmm. But with the 130s, you could take the APCs, the Armored Personnel Carriers, the bigger trucks, the radio equipment, the radio trucks, the Signals Regiment, all their stuff.
Very neat.
So, yes, we didn't have any tanks, so we didn't have to worry about lifting tanks. And we were more, I think, concerned with a United Nations type of operation than we were about moving. Well, as I say, we could have moved pretty well anything that the Army was equipped with, excluding tanks. But they didn't have any tanks at home. They were all in Europe anyway, so
no problem.
So it the lift varied on the density of the equipment and, of course, ammo, well, the whole nine yards. Everything that a battalion needed to fight, we would move.
Yeah.
We'd move then the artillery, the guns, you remember, they were those field pieces, the field guns, mountain guns or field guns, that were not not the heavy stuff because the artillery lost all that equipment.
Yeah.
The only one I can't remember... were the 109s, the mobile, the self-propelled 109s, and I'm not too sure whether we moved any of those or not. We didn't have very many, but I can't remember. I think we did in the 130. Well, so it depended on what the composition was. So, but it was a big lift capability.
Yeah.
And now here is where the concept of the hours came in. By not letting anybody go on leave or anything like that, stopping all training, squadron training, and having all of the squadron personnel available and all of the ground crew available, we could keep those airplanes going around the clock, and we would have what we call a slip crew. We'd just position the crew somewhere, and the airplane would land and be unloaded. It would be serviced immediately, and as soon as it was ready, a new crew would take over. The old crew would go to bed immediately, and they'd try and get the radar asleep. And then they would be ready to take over again when their number came up. So that there was quite a, it was quite a sheet working out the airplanes, the serials for each airlift, the time of that airlift, where it was to, and then the crew time. Where would the crew slip? For example, a crew, shall we say, would work in, could fly 12 hours and then have to be relieved at the end of 12 hours. Well, the flight may be 8 hours one way, 4 hours back, and you're halfway there. You can't change.
Right.
So you'd have to then figure out, well, do we extend? And we had authority to extend. The AOC had the authority to extend crew days, but it had to be his authority. And so the AOC would then have to say, when in the planning of the operation, all right, I'll authorize extended crew days for that man, but he must now have a 12-hour off at the end of that. So the planners, the operational planners, would then take all this criteria and put it on sheets and work it out. God, if we'd only had computers in those days, how simple it would have been to work out all the numbers and the combinations to make the whole damn thing go. And it had to be right, because if you blew, if you made one little mistake anywhere, then not only that particular serial, but all succeeding serials would be all screwed up. So it had to be right. And when we got down to that planning, that stage of the planning, it was always done very, very carefully and was always checked. In other words, somebody would do the planning, a team would do the planning, another team would check it, just to make sure that there were no mistakes made.
Yeah.
So, but the concept worked. So that when we got to these periods of very high intensive operations, evacuation from UNEF, from when that blew up in our face, we had to get the people out of Egypt in an awful hurry. That was that was as close as we've ever come to a shooting situation where it was important to get people out. Well, that was just a steady stream of airplanes, and there we did go to extended hours. In other words, we went to our maximum participation because we knew it would only be for a few days. In other words, days to get them out. The key was to get them out as quickly, immediately. And not a question of, well, we could afford to take a week to do it, or 2 weeks to do it. It had to be done as quickly as possible. So there it was, go right up, maximum operation for that short, doing it would be a short period of time. So the bloody airplanes never stopped going, and unserviceabilities were frowned on by that. I mean, and even there you had flexibility, too. I mentioned unserviceabilities. We even developed a system where we had a go-no-go system. Now, a pilot, when he landed, would report unserviceabilities. And we had a list of those unserviceabilities which were acceptable. In other words, under a pressure, under an operational condition. In a normal peacetime operation, the airplane would have been made put unserviceable by the pilot or the captain of the airplane and would remain unserviceable until it was fixed by the ground crew. Well, under operational conditions, there are certain unserviceabilities that you would accept. But there was a line where flight safety came into play. And, of course, once flight safety came into play, then that was it. There was the airplane was unserviceable until fixed. But you could fly the airplane with a series of minor, what we call minor unserviceabilities, and we did. Now, what that did, of course, was it reduced the workload on the maintenance people, who could then concentrate on the important unserviceabilities when they occurred.
So there's no door, so who needs a door?
That kind of thing. And sometimes you had a lot of duplication, too. For example, needing navigation instruments. If you had, we had backups. Well, if the backup went unserviceable, and it was a flight where navigation was not going to be a major difficulty because of other systems that could be used, then we'd let that system be unserviceable until the operation was over. If two went unserviceable, then it became a no-go situation. That was the sort of thing that all had to be worked out very carefully, and the pilots had to know about this. Well, the thing became bloody involved, and it reached a point where crews were arriving a good 2 hours before their takeoff time, a good 2 hours into the ops room, were being briefed by the squadron operations officer, and they had to go through all of their flying, a review of all of these go-no-go situations, and God, they come out of that damn thing almost worn out before they got into the airplane. That's an exaggeration, but it was a very complex thing that we had involved, but the great thing was that it did work. And touching wood, Air Transport Command is yet to kill a passenger. They've never yet killed a passenger. They've had accidents, but they've never killed a passenger. They have killed some of their own people on training flights and so forth, but they've never actually killed a passenger. And we've had some awfully close calls. I don't mean but they were always technical, not aircrew. Most accidents you hear about are, you'll hear pilot error or something. Well, that's human error. The ones we had were dreadful things. I can remember one time a 130. The 130 was flying from Lakehead to Winnipeg, and it was over the rocks, in Western Ontario, that very terrible area, before you get to Kenora, really. Nothing there.
Yeah.
And for some unknown reason, the door, which is on the side of the 130, just aft of the cockpit, the door it didn't just pop out. It came out in such a way that it took all the metal that was attached to the door and just peeled all the whole way around the airplane. Just peeled all the way around.
My God.
As if you'd taken off a piece of orange peel all the way around. Well, it took out a couple of engines while it was doing this, of course, because there were the two inside engines were hit by this thing as it was going around. And he had a full load on board. Well, that captain did one, and then I could go on for hours about incidents and the quality of the aircrew that were in, that certainly, and I believe ATC still maintains the same standards, I sincerely hope they do. But that boy and his crew did a simply magnificent job, no panic. They declared an emergency, of course, over radio, but there was no way they could land in those rocks, because by now they knew that they were going to have to do a belly landing where they couldn't put their wheels down on all that rock and woods and so forth. And they began to get rid of what they could out of the airplane to try and loosen it, but there was all heavy stuff. It was beyond their, really, they couldn't open the hatch door because that would have brought their airspeed down further and they would have fallen out of the sky. The captain had a lot of fast thinking to do and a lot of really life-saving decisions to make in a matter of a very short period of time, and he made everyone the right one. Well, they kept going, losing altitude, and he hung in there and hung in there until he just got beyond the rocks and the first wheat field on the prairies, and it was stubble. It was in the fall. They'd actually cut the crop. And he finally put that bird down on its belly in that wheat field, and for a good 100 yards, now the stubble was about a foot high, or perhaps even less than that, and he flew that bird onto the ground so beautifully that for 100 yards, the top of the stubble had been cut another few inches off the top of the stubble. Until she reached the stall, and then she just quietly dropped on. That plane was recovered within 48 hours, and a patch job done on it, and it was flown out of that same field by the same captain, went back and flew that airplane out. Just terrific. Well, the quality, as I say, the caliber, other stories in the Yukons of fuel problems, pumps going. With a new airplane, you never knew what the design was of some of these emergency procedures, and had the engineers thought of every possible emergency, and therefore an emergency system devised for it. And another one of a Yukon that ran into fuel problems, and again, an engineer who did just a magnificent job in transferring fuel not in accordance with the book, but boy, he used his head. It was the only way they were going to not crash, and by God, he did it, and they landed, and as they were attacked, on the runway, all four engines stopped running. That was a whole great big Yukon airplane that could have gone in. No? Well, I just can't say enough about the quality of the people that we had. So when it came, their judgment was always so bloody good. And even operationally, we had another case of where we had an airplane go unserviceable down in Nairobi. And I guess it was the National Defense College. And they were on a very, very tight schedule. And we had to get a replacement airplane to them in a hurry. Well, by this time we had single-sideband communications. And we could talk to our airplanes. If we wanted to, even with the Americans, we could talk to them pretty well anywhere in the world by patching through the American net as well as our own. Mm. If we couldn't talk to them from Trenton or from Marville, where we had another SSB, that we could patch through the Americans. Anyway, we got hold of another Yukon that was in the area, within the Mediterranean, and he was on just a straight run the island. In the Mediterranean, where we're still
Cyprus.
Cyprus.
Yeah.
He was on the run to Cyprus. So It was a combined freight and passenger run. No priority, just a normal routine run. So we talked to him on the radio, and we said, all right, land, get rid of your load, and then take off immediately. Well, we had to talk about, here's where we had to talk about extended hours, because he had just had a long flight. And he was not out of crew time, but by the time he'd gotten to Nairobi, he was going to be a very tired boy. Well, we had to make the decision, or I had to make the decision, to let him say, okay, extend his crew day. He said, I'm fine, don't worry about it. As a matter of fact, he said, I had a couple of hours ziz in the bunk, and I'm okay. So, and we accepted their judgment, because they were terribly mature people. Some of these kids were 21, 22 years old, but my God, their maturity in terms of judgment was just superb. Again, it's training, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, we said, all right, now the great problem is that we don't have any overflight clearances for you. Now, you take off, and we'll try and get the overflight clearances immediately from External Affairs.
Yeah.
Well, we began. And of course, we got through to Cairo, and we got overflight clearances immediately from Egypt, no problem. But the Sudan, do you think we could get any overflight clearances? Well, God, we couldn't even talk to anybody. So we got hold of the boy and said, all right, here's your Cairo clearance. Keep on going, and we're trying to get to Saddam. And just hang in there. Well, of course, we never did get a Saddam overflight clearance. And when he hit the Saddam air traffic control, he was handed over by Cairo, and of course, it didn't take Saddam more than 30 seconds to realize that they didn't have an overflight clearance for this airplane. So they began to question the captain, you see, and the captain just strung out a tale like you wouldn't believe. I'm like, you've got to have it. Now go back and check. You must have it. You see. And he literally talked his way through the Sudan, and of course we were all right in Kenya.
Yeah.
Well, that was the kind of thing that the captains, of their own initiative, would do.
Yeah.
And we didn't have to tell him what to do. He knew that if he was going to get through that. Well, come on, long story short, they got down there, and the NDC, the crew of the original airplane was rested, waiting for this one to come. As soon as it got in, they just refueled it, and away they went. And the NDC only lost about 3 or 4 hours in their whole program. Well, that kind of recovery job, and that kind of a little anecdote, it was the sort of thing that was happening, not all the time. Overflight clearances, you don't, if it had been some other country, we would have had fighters on our tail.
Yeah.
We had to do a quick check. We said, Sudan, what the hell do they have, anyway?
Yeah.
what can they do to us, other than perhaps a diplomatic note? Yes,
yeah.
Incident.
Yeah.
And we said, well, we're willing to accept that. And there was a bit of a rattle, and External Affairs just apologized profusely and said there had been some confusion. We thought we had received it because it was in your net. And so, the usual gobbledygook.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a captain that pulled it off.
Yeah. This is before the Entebbe raid.
Yeah, oh yes, very much so, very much so. Well, those operational airlifts, and then we had the UN operations were constantly coming up. We had people out in the Pacific, that tiny little operation that went on out in around near Indonesia. Forget the name of that damn place now, but that was a long haul. We had to fly airplanes out. Otters were being provided for that one from Air Transport Command, some communication otter airplanes, float planes. We had to fly those out. They had to be assembled out there, put together, and we had to set up a communications net to that outfit and then provide them with a weekly airlift out there. So then there was the Yemen. We had to, when we went into the Yemen, we had to do support into Aden, and then the airplanes, the two airplanes we had in Yemen, they would once a week come out to Aden and pick up the bits and pieces, the mail, the goodies, the beer, whatever it might be, and spare parts and so forth, and then fly back in again.
Yeah.
But the big lifts were things like the rotation of the battalion in Cyprus. That was then picked up and done by air. The evacuation out of them. Oh, I'm sorry, when we're talking about the rotation of the army in Europe, there was another thing that they didn't like at all. And again, that really took almost the minister to decide on that one. When the army rotated, of course, they like to rotate by unit. They like to do a whole unit rotation. And when they were bringing units back from Europe, back to Canada, they pretty well take over a whole ship, and the battalion would march on board and with families, and that would be it. They'd be home, and they'd arrive back. Well, we, of course, couldn't lift them, the battalion, all in one lift. Mm-hmm. So it had to be phased. And this caused them a lot of heartburn because it meant that for the time period of the lift, of the rotation of that battalion or that unit, that from an operational point of view, that unit was non-effective to the extent that their replacements had to tie in with the company or whatever it might be of the unit was still there mm-hmm. and had not yet actually gone on board an airplane. Mm-hmm. So there were those days, and it was days, when that unit was in not a negative state of operational responsibility, but it was, they would be able to fight, but it would not have been people who were used to each other. You know, they had, say, a company from one battalion and two companies from the other. And then it would be two of the one and one of the other until the whole thing was... They didn't like that. But the decision was made that in view of the economies that could be affected doing it this way. And there were other economies. All those days that would have been spent on board ship were now not lost.
Yeah.
In a matter of hours that the individual was back in Canada, would then go off on repat leave, or whatever leave he was entitled to, but would save 4 and sometimes 5 or 6 days mm-hmm. in terms of manpower.
Yeah.
So man days were being saved by this sort of by the air rotation.
Yeah.
And those became important factors in the decision to go with this kind of thing. I don't know what we would have done in Air Transport Command if we had not sold the concept. Because nothing bores a pilot more than boring holes in the sky.
With an empty...
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's just wasting...
Yeah.
You don't... He doesn't... There's not the same feeling. You don't get the same drive. You're not on your toes. There's a hell of a difference between a pilot flying an airplane that's empty in the back of him and one with 150 wives and children in the back.
Yeah.
He's a different man up front in that thing. He's on his toes, bingo, all the time. Just like a needle points, watching all the time, never relaxing for a second, because if something goes wrong, he's got to be able to respond quickly.
Yeah.
So, and this was the level of expertise that we were looking for.
In other words, you were creating an airline.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Well, as a result of that airline, we ran into all kinds of opposition, because it didn't take long for the Air Transport Association, made up of all the various operators in Canada, the civilian airlines, civilian operators, to realize that here was a good thing. And why shouldn't they have that business? Why shouldn't they be doing all this flying? And I guess the first real crunch I had as a commander was to defend the concept in Ottawa against the air transport operators who were desperately keen to pick up all that transatlantic work, to do the freight run across Canada that we were doing again. I didn't elaborate on that. Instead of it taking days for spare parts to get from, say, the major depot in Toronto to, say, Edmonton, and I apply this to the Army as well as to the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And the Navy got in on it too, and from coast to coast. Anything that could be airlifted. Instead of it being days and days and days waiting for a part to come by express or by freight, heck, we would run that damn thing into the Air Movements Unit, and there was an Air Movements Unit right at Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be there, it'd be on the airplane that day or the next day, and would be delivered that night. And the airplane would be serviceable that night. It would be immediately what we call an AOG, an aircraft on the ground. That's priority number one for air movement of freight. If an aircraft on the ground, the part that's needed to get that airplane in the air must have top priority.
Yeah.
So an AOG. Well, an AOG in the old days, you'd wait for the damn express to arrive by train, and it would be days. You knew, you'd just forget about the airplane for those days. Once we started doing this across country freight delivery, as a part of our system, that airplane would only be on the ground a matter of hours, not days.
Yeah.
So these are starting. Well, the airline operators, of course, wanted this. They could see, this is just great business, and I had to defend it. And boy, I had to do it several times. I even had to come out here to Victoria when the Air Transport Association had a conference and defend it, an annual meeting, and defend it again there. But we won our case. We won on that very simple thing. If we're going to have to operate in an emergency and go into places where you won't go, and this was one thing about the airlines, they would not go into some of the places that we would go in under the conditions.
Yeah.
We said you'd have to go in under operational conditions, and what is more, you might even be shot at.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was just the end of that. Cool. And we said, if we're going to be able to go in and under operational conditions and do the requirement in the time period that's required, we've got to use this system in peacetime the way we're using it right now. We've got to keep our people up to speed at a high enough level of operations so we can step up and meet the operational requirement. And no way can you do that. And that was the way we won our case. And it still applies today. I haven't heard of the airlines making an effort to take over what Air Transport Command has been doing for years and years and years.
Yeah.
They've realized that it is a valid case, and that's it. And of course, so does the cabinet.
Yeah.
So that it has it's and that's the way they're operating today, exactly the same way.
Well, now there's two things that occur to my mind, Reg. During that period, and during the present period, as far as I know, right now we have no bombers. As such.
Yeah, that's right.
Could your air transport be converted to bombers?
Negative.
They couldn't.
No way. There was just the design of the airplane was such that there was just no way you could convert it into a bomber. No way at all. There was no adaptability at all. For the work that would be required to make one, you might as well build a bomber. In other words, you'd have to rebuild the airplane.
Just put in some
rats.
Machine gun turrets and rats.
Yep. No way. The modification to the airplane would have been of such a structural nature that it would have been easier to build a new airplane.
Oh,
he
did.
Yeah. No application at all. No.
Another thing, of course, that occurs to me with your pilots, more or less, shall we say, having to be ready to go almost anywhere at any time. What about things like passports and whatnot? Or do they just have their military passport and that's that? Or military ID?
Everybody had a passport.
Oh.
Not only did all the air crew and a lot of the ground crew have to have passports, but everybody had to be up on their inoculations.
Yeah.
Because we never knew where we were going to go. And the doctors began to get a little worried about what is the tolerance level for inoculations. Because nowhere in the world can anyone receive the doses over such an extended period of time as our air crew and some of our ground crew were getting.
Yeah.
For example, I guess it was typhus. Typhus is, I think it's every 6 months. So, in other words, every 6 months. Hell, I had a yellow book that was full. I was working, I think, on my second or third book by the time I finished with Air Transport Command. We had people that docs had to stop giving shots to.
Yeah.
They were beginning to react to them. So, passports was one thing. If a visa was required, normally, again, it was a United Nations operation. And there was enough time from the planning in New York, or when the decision was made by the Security Council that some action would take place.
Yeah.
Although the Secretary General was given the authority to go ahead and get the thing going, he normally liked things to happen in about 24 or 48 hours. But we always knew that, number one, the discussion was going on in the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, whether Canada was going to take any part in it or not.
Mm.
And if External Affairs said, no way are we going to contribute to this, then we relaxed.
Yeah.
But if External said, yes, if this comes up, we are going to participate, then we knew that we were involved. Well, then we would go through External to the countries involved, and either through the United Nations or through our ambassadors, depending on how we were represented, for all of the overflight requirements that would be required to affect that operation. And also to have our people land without the right visas. If visas were a requirement.
Yeah, got it.
So that it would, because more, with that type of thing, it was a question of getting in and out again. We weren't going to stay because we didn't want, number one, we didn't want the airplane to stay there. Number two, we didn't have any facility to put people up. Not until the troops that we were moving in had a chance to establish themselves somewhere. And then once they got established, then we would look at it. Maybe they might give a tent over or some tents or even a building, depending where it was, that could then be used for the air crew to go and sleep in.
Yeah.
But initially, it was in and out as far as the airplane and crew were concerned. So as far as our people were concerned, the visas were never a headache. Passports, we always make sure the boys carry, but that was as much as anything in case they ran into trouble, in case they had to, there was an unserviceability, and they had to stay. Well, where were they? If it was in a country where there was some civilization and there were hotels, then they would have to go and stay in a hotel. Well, they may not have a visa, but at least they would have a passport, mm-hmm. which was a step in the right direction.
What about the foreign money?
Money, we always traveled with American currency. And the captains always had an imprest. And the imprest varied in size according to the type of the operation. But it was not uncommon for a captain of an airplane to be given an imprest of $5,000. If it was some of our flights which were around the world, he'd be given an imprest of $10,000. Mm-hmm. And it would be in folding money. And this would be just for those times when he had to buy gas and nothing else would be accepted. Credit cards, letters of credit, no deal. They wanted folding money. We went into places where if you didn't have folding money, you'd never get out of there. So he had, we knew all this, of course. Yeah. We gained this experience, training. And the way we learned this, I was on, when I went and, I mentioned earlier about going to the first Colombo conference in 1949 with Pearson. Now that round-the-world flight was the first time an RCF airplane had been around the world. Here we were now with equipment that might have to go around the world, or halfway around, go anywhere. So we began to run training flights. And as captains came along and began to be ready to be full captains, we would, in our OTU, then we would send them on trips around the world with a check pilot. And we always varied the flight, the route of that thing. We could plan these well in advance. These would all be planned 6 months in advance. So we'd have all the overflight clearances, and we knew exactly what the time schedule would be, and so the countries knew, and visas and everything else would all be taken care of. This was planning, training planned well in advance. But when the pilots came back, one of the big things I had to do was sit down and write a report on the snags they ran into, the difficulties they had at that particular airport, customs, whatever it might be, which then became a log and a record of when you land at that place, here is what you can expect. So we built up a history by going all over the place, all over the bloody place with these flights. And it worked. It was beautiful because when we did have an operation, where we had to go out to certain parts of the world, going through and staging through, we just turned up the book of the words, and there it all was. And the captains were briefed and knew exactly what to expect when they landed, and that was it. And it was invariably right. So that was experience, which helped us.
Yeah.
So we built up and still have a knowledge in Air Transport Command that is quite unique.
I imagine, too, that your map library must be fantastic.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Here, of course, we had to rely on the Americans, because we were using American aeronautical charts. And the Americans, of course, have always had first-class aeronautical charts. Mm-hmm. But we had, well, again, to take the load off the captains. Mm-hmm. Because of this, I mentioned the 2-hour pre-briefing, mm-hmm. all the work that had to go into that. Oh, God. You should have a captain just walk through what he had to do in that 2-hour period. But to take the pressure off for himself and the first officer and the navigator, the people in the operations room were made responsible for putting together